This is Molly Smith, host of From the Median. It is my pleasure to introduce to you David Barton, president and founder of Wall Builders. His topic is Rebuilding America's Founding Principles from the Grassroots to the Presidency.
4% of the world should produce 4% of the world's inventions. No, no, no. We produce more than the other 96% combined. And then even when you look at our prosperity, we're unlike any other nation with prosperity. You take, for example, where we are as a people. And again, we are only 4%, but this year we will produce 25% of the world's gross domestic product. And that's not because we have greater natural resources, because we don't. I'm a rancher. I'm a cowboy. I'm from Texas. Got the ranch, got the horses, got the pickup, got everything that goes with it. And farmers, only 1% of America are farmers. And yet America produces enough food to feed the entire world. And it's not because we have more agricultural land. We're only 66 in the world in percentage of farmable land. But we take what we have and we make it produce unlike any other nation in the world. You see, that's nothing to be arrogant over. We've been very blessed as a people, and we've been that way for a number of years, way back in 1831. And by the way, just to show you how prosperous we are, every 10 years we do an enumeration of the people. The Constitution calls that the census, the enumeration of the people. According to figures from the Census Bureau, if you happen to live below the poverty level in America, and we don't want anyone living below the poverty level, not in America, but if you happen to live below the poverty level in America, you're more likely to own a telephone, you're more likely to own a television, an air conditioner, you're more likely to own an automobile, grab this, you're more likely to eat more red meat, and you're more likely to have more square footage of living space than the average middle class in Europe. So you get that. If you're in poverty in America, your lifestyle is higher than middle class in Europe. The World Bank sets a standard for poverty every year. This year it's $456 a year. If you make below $456 a year, you're in poverty. That's the World Bank. If you're a prospering nation, they raise the amount to $730 a year. There are 1.9 billion people in the world who live on that less than $456 a year. That's the poverty standard for the world. In America, the poverty standard is $40,000. We're 100 times higher than the rest of the world. That's why everybody in the world wants to come to America and live in poverty. They can just be in poverty here, they raise their lifestyle. I mean, we are so blessed, we don't even recognize how blessed we are. Now, this is a term that's given us back in 1831. It's called American exceptionalism. Alexis de Tocqueville traveled to America, saw that. He said, the conditions of the Americans are exceptional. I don't think any other nation will attain to that. How did we get American exceptionalism? By the way, what is it? A lot of people can't even define it today. Professors hate it. I deal in the educational community, and so many of the progressive and the secular professors, they just hate this concept of American exceptionalism. They can't define it, but they don't like it. American exceptionalism, very simply, describes the unprecedented stability, freedom, and prosperity that is a result of institutions and policies that are produced by unique governing philosophy. Now, notice the sequence. We had a specific philosophy that produced our institutions and policies. Those institutions and policies, that's what produces the fruit that we enjoy, the stability and the prosperity and the freedom. But it all goes back to the particular philosophy. Other nations across the world had philosophies on which they built their governments. It has not worked out the same. It has not been the same. We have a philosophy unlike any other nation in the world. Now, most Americans today cannot identify what our philosophy is, but quite frankly, that philosophy is the most important part of any nation. It's like a fruit tree. I mean, take a fruit tree. You start by planting a seed. Once you plant that seed will grow up and produce structure. It will produce those institutions and policies, if you will. From that structure, that's what produces the fruit, and that's what we all enjoy. But the most important part is the type of seed that you plant. If you plant the wrong seed in a government, you will get the wrong fruit out of that government. If you plant the right seed, it will produce the right fruit. So the most important part is the seed. That's what I want to look at for a bit here. What made us unique? What made us different from other nations? And I'll show you how life fits within that concept. If you go back and look at this American exceptionalism, what philosophy, what was the seed that we planted? Well, we are told in our birth certificate, we have in that birth certificate, we start with 126 words that set forth five immutable principles of government. Everything in the Constitution goes back to one of these five principles. This is the entire philosophy of American government. Let me take you through those phrases. We start with a very simple phrase that says, all men are created equal, they're endowed by their creator. Now, what we say in that phrase is we in government. This is not a declaration of private beliefs. This is a government document. You cannot be part of the United States as a state and not adhere to the declarations, the Declaration and the Constitution. Those are inseparable documents. That's why Article 7 of the Constitution dates itself not to the Constitution, to the Declaration. Every presidential act signed by every president does not date itself to the Constitution, dates itself to the Declaration. It goes back to 1776 because that's the governing document. Constitution supports everything in one of these five principles. So we believe, first off, there's a divine creator. Now, the court has told us for about 40 years that, well, that's okay for you to believe privately and personally, but that we can't have that stuff out in public. No, look at the document. This belief that there's a divine creator is the unanimous declaration of the the 13 United States of America. Later on, they say that we in General Congress assembled as representatives of the people. It's unanimous. All the states, all the official government bodies say, we officially believe there's a creator. That's not a matter of personal opinion. That's not an optional choice. That is our philosophy of government. We start with that. That is so significant that when Washington became the first president of the United States, he issued the first ever federal call to prayer for the American people. I have that actual original document. We're very blessed. We own about 100,000 documents from before 1812. I own thousands of handwritten documents of George Washington, John Adams, Thomas Jefferson, etc. And this is first call ever, calling the federal nation to a time of remembering God, time of prayer. Why did Washington do that? He tells us right here at the top. Washington tells us why he called the nation to remember God, a nation to a time of prayer. This is what he said. He says, whereas it is the duty, and notice the word duty. Military still uses that word, but by and large, that's fallen out of our conversations today. The word duty back then also does not mean what it does now. If you will check a dictionary from the founder's day, the word duty means a legally binding contractual obligation. It's the same as if you signed a contract. In 1913, the word duty was defined to be a requirement, and today it is defined as that which one ought to do. Now, there's a big difference between what one ought to do and a legally binding contractual document. Washington used the word duty by their definition. It is the duty. It is a legally binding contractual obligation of all nations, not individuals, of all nations to do four things. Look what George Washington said. Four things nations should do. Number one, they should acknowledge the providence of Almighty God. Number two, it's the duty of nations to obey His will. Number three, it's the duty of nations to be grateful for His benefits. And number four, it's the duty of nations to humbly implore His protection and favor. Now, that's the duty of nations. See, that's what we believe, is this is not a matter of private declaration. We as a nation start with the belief that there is a divine creator. Now, that's significant, because that belief there's a divine creator. The second thing we believe, we're endowed by our creator with certain inalienable rights. See, we believe that there is a creator, and we believe the creator gives us a certain set of rights that are different from government-given rights. Government-given rights are what are called social compact rights. God-given rights are what are called inalienable rights. Now, fortunately for us, the Founding Fathers defined the term inalienable. Most people recognize that word today. They cannot give an adequate definition of it. So let's go back to what is an inalienable right. Well, the guys who wrote the documents define it for us. For example, John Dickinson not only helped with the Declaration, he went on to become a signer of the Constitution. He was a general in the American Revolution. He said an inalienable right is a right which God gave to you and which no inferior power has a right to take away. If it came from God, government's not allowed to touch it. If it's not a social compact rights, that's what comes from government. That's what health care is. Government gave that right so the government can regulate it, can take it away, can alter it, can change it. But inalienable rights come from God, and government's not allowed to touch that. You see, this is a matter of jurisdictions. Let me explain it this way. Because I am a cowboy and I have a nice pickup, my pickup is a Ford pickup that is red. I like red Ford pickups. I see a white Ford pickup over in my neighbor's yard. I go over there and I paint it red because I like red Ford pickups. I can't do that. I don't have the authority to go over in his yard and mess with something that doesn't belong to me. I can paint anything I want red, but I can't go over. See, that's the way government is. Government says, oh, no, that one belongs to God. We can't mess with that. Now, the one over in our yard, we can do what we want to. I can paint it purple pink polka dots if I want to. But God's, I can't touch. You see, that's what we recognize, was there is a creator. The creator gives a certain guaranteed set of rights that man is not allowed to touch. And that's why he said no inferior power has a right to take it away. Look how Alexander Hamilton said it. He's a signer of the Constitution, obviously a general in the Revolution, one of the authors of the Federalist Papers. This is what he said. He said, inalienable rights are not to be rummaged for among old parchments or musty records. These are not things you find written down in government documents that government gave you. He says, they're written as with the sunbeam and the whole volume of human nature by the aid of divinity itself and can never be erased or obscured by any mortal power. These are God-given rights that government cannot touch. Look how it's defined by John Adams. I love this definition. John Adams said, inalienable rights, he said, they're antecedent to all earthly government, and they cannot be repealed or restrained by any human laws. Their rights derive from the great legislator of the universe. Now, this concept, look at what he says, they're antecedent to all human rights, or all human government. Antecedent means comes before. What is the first human government in the history of man? It's Noah. Noah, when he got off the ark in Genesis 9, God gave him what are called the Noahide laws, seven categories of laws. That's the first justice system. That's the first legal government. So inalienable rights are antecedent to the first government. That means they appear in Genesis 1 through 8. I'll tell you more about that later, how the founding fathers looked at Genesis 1 through 8. Any right that appeared in Genesis 1 through 8 was a right that was given by God, not government, because government didn't even exist yet. So those are inalienable rights, but what specifically are our inalienable rights? Sam Adams, who's the father of the American Revolution, said, well, in the Declaration, we told you that among others, there were three. He said, there's a right to life, secondly, to liberty, and thirdly, to property. And then 11 years later, when we had finished the Constitution of the United States and we wrote the Bill of Rights, we said, you remember we told you 11 years ago that among others, there was life, liberty, and property? Well, let us give you some of the others. You have the First Amendment right to worship God according to the dictates of conscience. That is a guaranteed, God-given, inalienable right. The second right you have is the Second Amendment, the right to keep and bear arms, what they call the biblical right of self-defense. In the Third Amendment, you have the sanctity of the home. The Fourth Amendment, you have the right to justice laid out in the Scriptures. Jesus covers that even in John 8. The Fifth Amendment, you have the right to property. All of these are God-given inalienable rights. And so that's what the Bill of Rights listed was other inalienable. These are rights that government can't mess with. They come from God. So that's our second belief, is that government, that there are a certain set of rights that come from the Creator. Now, the third belief, I came back on. Love it. The third belief says that to secure these rights, governments are instituted among men. What you get from this, you have now been told the purpose of government. Why does government exist? To secure these rights. That's why we have governments. You see, that's what happened back with Noah, because God gave the right to life to all human beings, but Cain violated the right to life, and then it became so common to violate the right to life that God wiped it out, and he started again. And when Noah gets off the ship, he said, Noah, here's the deal. Whoever sheds man's blood, by him will man's blood be shed. I'm going to make sure government protects the right to life. You're supposed to have a right to life. You can't let people take other people's lives. That's what government was created for, is to protect inalienable rights that came in the first eight chapters of Genesis. So we understood that government exists primarily to protect inalienable rights. Look at what was said by James Wilson. James Wilson is one of only six founding fathers who signed the Declaration and the Constitution. He's the second most active member of the Constitutional Convention. He was put on the U.S. Supreme Court by George Washington as an original justice. He started the first law school in America. I have his original law books that he wrote for law students. Look what he told law students about the purpose of government. He said very simply, he said, the principal object of government is to acquire a new security for the enjoyment of rights which we were previously entitled by the immediate gift of our all-wise and all-beneficent Creator. The reason government exists is to make sure you can do what God told you you had the right to do. The inalienable rights he gave you, government exists to make sure you can practice those rights. Now, that is a problem across the world. A lot of people cannot practice their God-given rights. You have the God-given right to preach the gospel. Jesus gave us that in Matthew 28. Go climb up on the street corner in Saudi Arabia and preach the gospel. See how that works out. You've got the inalienable right to preach the gospel, but you have to have political protection to preach the gospel. And that's why governments are supposed to exist, to protect the rights that God gave you, that God told you you had. Now, a lot of governments do not recognize God or His laws, and therefore they don't protect what God said we could do. So now we have a pastor in Phoenix who was doing a Bible study in his home. He got thrown in jail for 90 days for having a Bible study in his home because the city code in Phoenix said you can't have a Bible study in your home. In America? Yeah. Go to religioushostility.org. There's 1,200 examples of those type of arrests that have crossed America in the last few years. 67-year-old man in Georgia sitting on a park bench, gave out a gospel tract to someone, spent 2 days in jail for doing that. They called it parade. He didn't have a parade permit to give out. To sit on a park bench? It's ridiculous, but see, we're losing the political protection we had to practice our inalienable rights, even of our faith. So that's why government exists. Look how Samuel Adams said it. Sam Adams said, government was originally designed for the preservation of the inalienable rights. That's why you have government, to preserve what God told us we have the right to do in Genesis 1 through 8. And by the way, he says those inalienable rights are first, a right to life, secondly, to liberty, thirdly, to property. Now, you see that, and I want to emphasize this first as a right to life, because Wouldn't it be really cool if back then they had been talking about abortion? Because then when we go into court today, we could have said, oh, you know, from the very start, the constitutional basis, the original intent. And, you know, obviously that was not the deal with Roe v. Wade, because we couldn't talk original intent because that's not what they were talking about. And who says? What makes us think that they weren't talking about abortion? The Bible does say there's nothing new under the sun, Ecclesiastes 1:9. As long as there have been people who were pregnant, there were people who didn't want to be pregnant. Abortion's nothing new. The technology has changed over, and that's what happens. Behavior doesn't change. Technology changes. You see, one of the proofs that they dealt with it back then, this is a book we own in our library. This is Abortions in America back in 1808. This was something discussed very openly by the founding fathers. The right to life did mean the issue of abortion. As a matter of fact, let me take you back to James Wilson in his law books. Look what he tells students in his law books about the abortion issue. He says, students, with consistency, beautiful and undeviating, human life, from its commencement to its close, is protected by the common law. He said, in the contemplations of law, life begins when the infant is first able to stir in the womb, and by the law, that life is protected. Now, that sounds like the abortion issue to me. He said, as soon as you know there's life in the womb, right there at that instant, you're protected. And by the way, what did he say you're protected by? He said, by the common law. See that? It's protected by the common. That's the Seventh Amendment to the Constitution. You see, we argue abortion under the Ninth Amendment and the 14th Amendment of the right to privacy. No, no, no. It's a common law issue. It goes back to the Seventh Amendment. And I'll tell you more about the common law in a bit. He said, this issue of life, it's protected by the common law. He says, when the infant is first able to stir in the womb. Now, back then in that day, 200 years ago, how long did it take you for sure to know that there was life in the womb? You're talking weeks, 2 months, 3 months. Today, we know within 8 days of fertilization when life begins. The point is, as soon as you know that there's life in the womb, at that point, life is protected by government, by the common law. See, it's the technology differs, but the issue is exactly the same. Matter of fact, I love the way that John Witherspoon did it. He was a president of Princeton University, signer of the Declaration. He said that there's a big difference between America and Europe. He said in Europe, parents think that they give life to parents. Or parents think they give life to children. He said, we know better than that. He said, we know that life comes from God. It's not parents that give life to children. It's God that gives life to children. He said, and in Europe, because they think parents give life to children, in Europe they let them have abortions. They let you take the life of your kid because you think you give life to the kid, so you can take that life. He said, not in America. And that's what he pointed out. He said, a perfect right in the state of natural liberty is the right to life. He said, in America, we deny the power of life and death to parents. We don't let them take the life of their children because kids don't come from parents. They come from God. And we understood that. That's a God-given inalienable right. So if you take this thing about first as a right to life, I want to emphasize the word first for a moment. I'm very involved in the political community. I had a political office in Texas for 9 years. I've trained about 2,100, 2,200 candidates for office. I recruit all sorts of folks for office. There's probably 100 members of Congress I consider to be very good friends right now. I deal with legislators all the time. And what I've learned over the years is if I can find out first where someone is on the life issue, if I can find out what they believe about the life issues with a 90% degree of certainty, I can tell you how they will vote on every other issue. If I know where someone is on the life issue, I will tell you how they voted on the UN Convention on the Rights of the Child. I'll tell you what they did with TARP. I'll tell you what they did with stimulus. I'll tell you what they did with the Small Arms Treaty. If I know where they are on the issue of life, I can tell you with a 90% degree of certainty where they will be on every other issue. And the reason is very simple. Life is the first of the inalienable rights. If you won't protect the first, you're not good at protecting the second or the third or the fourth or any of the other rights. And that's why if someone's wrong on the life issue, you'll find that they're also wrong on the First Amendment right to worship God according to the dictates of conscience. You can't let that kid say God at graduation. What were you thinking? Separation of church and state. See, you don't get the life issue right, you don't get public religious expression of the rights of conscience right. If you don't get the life issue right, you don't get the Second Amendment right to defend yourself. You say, oh, you can't do that. Well, that's a biblical right of self-defense. It goes back to Exodus 22:2 and other passages, Luke 11:31. All these biblical passages, you can't do that. Well, if you're wrong on the life issue, you'd be wrong on the self-defense issue. If you're wrong on the life issue, you'd be wrong on the Third Amendment right on the sanctity of the home. Isn't it amazing how the people who are pro-abortion are also anti-traditional marriage? The two things go together. If you get life wrong, you will get the view of the home wrong. If you get the life issue wrong, you'll be wrong on the Fifth Amendment, the right to have private property protected. And government, oh no, government owns property, and it can take it from me. And if it wants to give it to somebody else, the Kelo decision we got from the Supreme Court. Government owns property, not individuals. If you're wrong on the life issue, you'll be wrong on every other issue. Now, granted, every one of these things is called a social issue. And our great political wisdom today, all of our great pundits tell us, Oh, people don't care about social issues. All they care about is economic issues. You got to stop talking about social. Well, all right, let's buy into that for just a moment. Let's say all we care about is economic issues. And if you do care about economic issues and that's the only thing you care about, you want to keep up with voting records that are done. And there's a lot of economic issues to care about, by the way. I mean, no shortage of that to look at. And so there's a lot of votes in Congress. You may not be aware, but in every session of Congress, they have between 10 and 13,000 bills introduced every session of Congress. So there are hundreds and hundreds of votes by congressmen, including hundreds of votes on economic issues. So if you're into economic issues, you want to look at the scorecards that come out by groups like Americans for Tax Reform, National Taxpayers Union, Freedom Works, all these economic, they don't care a whit about marriage, they don't care a whit about life, they don't care a whit about self-defense. All they care about is economic issues. What they do is they take those hundreds of votes and they rank every member of Congress from the best to the worst. The 100 percenters all the way down to the 0 percenters. You got 435 members in the House. You got 100 members in the Senate. And if you'll take and look at the best House members on economic issues, I put them up there. You start at the 100 percenters, and I could show you all 435 down to the 0, but that's the ones that fit on the screen. So you see all those 100 percenters up there? These are the folks who do the right thing with economic issues. And by the way, that's all we voters care about. At least that's what they keep telling us. If you will take the economic voting record and bump it up against the voting record of right to life groups, it happens to be a one-to-one correlation. Now, isn't that really interesting? And by the way, on the other side, if you take the worst representatives in Congress and if you'll bump them up against the life issue, you get exactly the same thing. It turns out if you're about 23% right to life, you're about 23% good on economic issues. If you're about 76% right to life, you're about 76% good on economic issues. Because you see, if they won't protect your life, they sure won't protect your money. Your life's a whole lot more important than your money. And if you get... if you get the life issue wrong, you'll be wrong on all other issues. Social issues, economic issues, it matters not at all. By the way, in Texas, where I helped run one of the political parties in Texas, we were able to convince the business community that we don't like all those social issues. Oh, they're so divisive and they create so much problem. And they said, all we care about is the business stuff. We said, well, guys, if you like business stuff, the guys who vote best on your issues are the guys who are pro-life. So if you really want good economic votes, you need to give money to pro-life candidates. We got all the business groups to start funding pro-life candidates, not because they like the life issue, because they like the results that are produced economically. So even at that, you can work coalitions in various ways, but it's easy to prove that life is the key issue. Now, with the life issue, it says first is a right to life, and tied right to that was another right. And it's part of our religious faith rights. You go back to the very early settlements of America, and you look at those who came to America, and the rights of conscience is what drove America more than any other issue from its very founding. People who were being persecuted for not believing the right thing and because they didn't all agree. And boy, do we have a lot of different beliefs in America, particularly on religious beliefs. Look how many denominations we have scattered all across America. But you see, that's why America was founded. And from the very beginning, you look at the original charters of for example, the charter with Rhode Island. You take the charter with Delaware and Massachusetts. They all gave protection for the rights of conscience. I mean, right up top, first off, a right to religious conscience. You can't be nailed for what you believe God wants you to do. If God wants you to do it, government can't nail you for doing that. And that's why John Quincy Adams said very simply, he said, the transcendent overruling principle of the first settlers was conscience. Well, because we believe that, when we wrote the Constitution, we protected that in the Constitution. I love the way John Jay said it. He's the original Chief Justice of the U.S. Supreme Court, one of the three authors of the Federalist Papers. Look what Chief Justice John Jay told us. He says, security under our Constitution is given to the rights of conscience and private judgment. They are by nature subject to no control but that of the deity. In that situation, they're now left free. See, the right to conscience, the right to answer to God for what you believe is one of those Genesis 1 through 8 rights. That's a right God gave us long before there was ever government. So that's an inalienable right. Government's to protect the rights of conscience because we answer to God, not government, for what we believe, what our faith is. That's not the government's issue. And we knew that. And because we had that policy, now, I've got two kids serving right now in the military. I'm a fan of the military. I support the military. But you know what? As much as I support... as much as I support, and we all support, I think, the military, it's interesting that when you look at that, the military provides all sorts of protection for the rights of conscience. By the way, this is a biblical issue. There's over 30 verses in the New Testament alone dealing with the rights of conscience. So God tells us very clearly about this. He even gives us a number of verses that tell us to craft our policies to protect the rights of conscience. And that's a biblical mandate. So we have not only from Genesis 1 through 8, we have the scriptures that say this is a God-given right. And that's why when you look legally at what we do in America, as much as I love the military, I will go to the mat for the rights of pacifists and Quakers and others not to have to fight in wars. You know, I'm supporting the military, but you know what? You believe God told you you don't pick up arms anytime ever, I'll go to the mat for you because you answer to God, not government on that issue. In the same way, I'm very patriotic. I love America. I think God's blessed America. I hope to be able to keep America on a sound footing. But I'll go to the mat for Jehovah's Witnesses who do not want to say the Pledge of Allegiance because it violates their right of religious conscience. They believe you pledge allegiance to nobody but God. All right? I'll go to the mat for you to be able to do that. Same way with Amish. Everybody else got to go to 12 years of school, compulsory education. Amish say, no, God only wants 8 years from our families. That's all. And we protect the rights of the Amish to have 8 years of education instead of 12, like all the laws say. We do the same thing with Christian Scientists. We don't make them vaccinate their kids, even though we have vaccination laws for kids going to school. We do the same thing with Muslim and Jewish men who feel like they've got to wear beards as part of their accountability to God. You might be in a job that says you've got to be clean shaven. Well, not if you believe that God, do you answer to God for the beard you have. We do the same thing with Seventh-day Adventists and Sabbatarians who don't want to work on the seventh day, on Saturday. It doesn't matter if you say that the contract says you have to work from Monday through Saturday. You don't have to work. See, we protect the rights of conscience. We always have in America. We have a long history of doing this, and now it's different. And it changed really in the 90s with, at that time, President Clinton was saying, hey, we've got to do this. Fetal tissue research, and that has now become embryonic research, embryonic stem cell. But fetal tissue research was going to change the world back then. 30 years, there won't be any disease left in the world because of fetal tissue research. And there were a whole lot of people back then that said, wait a minute, this is happening really fast, but this doesn't comport with my faith. I can't do this. And so over that period of the 90s, we saw all sorts of medical situations come up where people of Christian faith said, can't do it. You know, physician-assisted suicide, embryonic stem cell research, euthanasia, birth control, RU486, Plan B, all the things that are out there. I can't be part of this. I can't dispense drugs. I can't dispense contraceptives out of my pharmacy. Doesn't matter if I work for Walmart or something else. I can't. Well, we've always protected that, but then we started seeing the medical people get encroached on because this was new turf. We hadn't had that kind of medical discovery yet. And so as President Bush was leaving office, one of the things he did was give a conscience protection rule. But one of the first things that President Obama did was undo conscience protection. Now, that's really the first time by federal policy we've told you your conscience is not protected by law. See, it wasn't an inalienable right. It wasn't the option of the president to violate conscience. You answer to God. You don't answer to government. So not only did that happen, but then we went a lot further. And as the Obamacare bill went through, and you remember the vote we had on it, everybody said that, hey, this is going to affect conscience. Well, it turned out that was exactly right. We now have over 90 cases in the federal courts trying to protect the rights of a conscience under the health care law. So far, we're winning about 89-90% of those 90 cases. That has been heard at the Supreme Court. We will have a decision by the first week of June on whether conscience protection will continue to stand in America, the Hobby Lobby case and the Conestoga Wood case. That will be decided by June, and we'll see whether conscience protection is going to survive, whether government still exists to protect the inalienable rights, including the right of conscience. And then we started having trouble in the military. The National Defense Authorization Act is a bill that we do every 2 years. We fund the military from ground zero up every 2 years. And so what we did two sessions ago, in other words, 3 years ago, was we said, well, we're putting a right of conscience protection in there to say that chaplains can pray according to the dictates of their faith. Because chaplains, Catholic, Protestant, evangelical, gospel chaplains, you can't pray in Jesus' name. What do you think you're doing? Wait a minute. According to my faith, I've got to pray in Jesus' name. Well, you can't do that. There might be somebody that might be offended somewhere. So we inserted in that National Defense Authorization Act protections for the rights of conscience to pray according to the dictates of for chaplains to pray according to the dictates of conscience. Because I do prayer breakfast in the military all over the place. And you got Hindu chaplains and you got Muslim chaplains and you've got all sorts of chaplains that are out there. You got Jewish chaplains and everybody gets to pray according to the dictates of their faith except Christian chaplains. And that's not right. You can't do that. Anybody can pray according to the dictates of faith because you don't answer to the military for how you pray. You answer to God for how you pray. Real simple stuff. And then this time, what we did this past January was we said, all right, we've got a little further now because we have bases like Fort Polk, Louisiana that are now starting to do homosexual weddings on the basis And there's a lot of chaplains that will not do that. And they can't be forced to do that because that violates the dictates of their faith. So we inserted that, and President said, well, I'm going to veto that bill if you're going to protect the rights of conscience. And he finally signed the bill, but then notified Congress that he will not uphold the conscience protections in the National Defense Authorization Act. So conscience is under attack in a way that it never has been in the history of the United States. But that is an inalienable right. Government exists to protect that and all the other inalienable rights. William Livingston, who's a signer of the Constitution, who is a general of the Revolution, who is the governor of New Jersey, he says, consciences of men are not the objects of human legislation. You can't mess with it through human government. It comes at a higher level. That's like that red pickup that I want in somebody else's yard. I can't go over in their yard and mess with that because it doesn't belong. Consciences do not belong to government. They belong to God. You can't go over there and start messing with conscience because you disagree with it. And that's what we always understood and knew. So that's the third thing, is government exists to protect our inalienable rights. That's in our declaration. And by the way, as you go through the Constitution, the things you'll find are all lined up to do this. Then you get to the fourth one. This is an interesting clause. It says, and to assume among the powers of the earth a separate and equal station in which the laws of nature and nature's God entitles them. Now, there's an eight-word phrase there that doesn't mean much to us today, but it's the laws of nature and nature's God, and that tells us that there is a fixed, set moral law. Now, that phrase, the laws of nature and nature's God, actually was a direct quote from the most famous law book of that day written by Justice William Blackstone. He wrote those four-volume commentaries on the laws. Thomas Jefferson said that American attorneys read Blackstone's commentaries on the law like Muslims read the Quran. I mean, that is what attorneys studied. And so everybody in the country, when they saw that phrase, they knew exactly what it meant. Because Blackstone defined it in great detail in Volume 1, Chapter 2 on the individual rights and the rights individual laws. He talks about how that the laws of nature and nature's God reflects what he called the dual revelation of God that you see in Romans 1 and over in Psalms 19. What do you mean, dual revelation of God? Well, if you remember, and I get people who are not believers, who are not Christians, how can you say that you have a loving God? How could he send people to hell who have never heard the gospel? Well, that's answered in Romans 1. Romans 1 says, everything that can be known about God, including the intricacies of the Godhead, that's a deep subject, everything that can be known about God, including the intricacies of the Godhead, are revealed through what he has created so that even the heathen are without excuse. In other words, creation tells us everything you need to know. Now, the sin nature that we got from Adam's kind of goofed that up, and it's not as clear to us. And because we're not an agricultural people anymore, we don't see things that used to be obvious to people in agriculture. That's why the scripture says, be still and know that I'm God. If you can get out in nature and just sit down for a while and just look around and think about what you see, man, there's no way you're an atheist. I mean, you got to live in a city to be an atheist. You can't be in the country and be an atheist. You know, first time this cowboy went to New York City, I stood on top of the Empire State Building, and I looked, and as far as I could see, including with binoculars in every direction, everything there was made by man, except for Central Park. Everything was concrete, and I thought, it's no wonder the eight largest mental institutions of the world are in New York City. I mean, it's really, because if you can't get out where you can see and think about God. So, having said that, this is what Blackstone explained, the laws of nature. In other words, if I don't use anything in the scriptures, I can tell you what's right and wrong in so many areas. I can tell you, for example, that self-defense is a God-given right. See, I'm about to leave this next week. I'm taking horses. We're going to ride 140 miles of Mammoth Cave in Kentucky. So I'll take the horses. We'll take you got to have a good trail horse. If I tell that horse it's time to swim the river, if I want to go off a cliff, the goat trail on the side, that horse got to do exactly what I want. I got a great trail horse. She recently had a foal. I go in the barn to feed her, come running out with a hoof print in the middle of your forehead because it is kicked into her that you can't get near my young. I'm supposed to defend my young. By the way, this is my barn. What are you doing? No, it's not. It's my barn. I'm the one who put you there and feed. No, see, it's in her nature to defend her young, herself, her family, and her dwelling. It's just in her nature. That's what God put there. You can't pass a law to stop that. You can't pass a law that says horses can't kick in the head if you get close to their foal. You won't do any good. So I don't need the Bible to tell me there's a biblical right of self-defense. The same thing happens with liberty. You know, there's more than 10 million species. Raccoons don't enslave elk. Deer don't enslave possum. It doesn't happen. Well, why didn't the Founding Fathers believe that? Because they were all a bunch of slave owners. No, 70% of the Founding Fathers were hardcore abolitionists. And they pointed to 30% and said, guys, it violates the laws of nature. There's nothing in nature that does slavery. You can't do this. And by the way, abortion is the same way. More than 10 million species, there's not a species in nature that kills its young while it's still in the womb. That's a violation of all natural law. And you can believe, I believe in creation. You can believe in evolution. Doesn't matter at all. There's nothing in evolution that kills its young while it's still in the womb. Doesn't matter which viewpoint you have. It's a violation of all natural law. Same with homosexuality. Oh yeah, homosexuality occurs occasionally, but it's always an aberration in every society in which it occurs. In nature, more than 10 million species, it's always an aberration. Doesn't happen often, but when it does, it's not natural. It's not part of it. That's why the law books of the day called it a crime against nature. They didn't say it was a crime against the scriptures. It was called a crime against nature because it violates natural law. And you have the same thing with property. I mean, from the time something is born, it finds that which is its own and it protects that and it lives there. And that's where it does, raises its young. And so all of those are God-given inalienable rights. That came before government ever existed. But you know what? On the law of nature, you know, you got to think about it. Is theft common in the laws of nature? Oh, you bet. One of my horses is happy to chase off another horse and eat its feet. It doesn't say, you know, that's your feet, you eat yours off. It's happy to take anything it can get a hold of. And I got the same problem when it comes to adultery, because adultery is really common in nature. That's why we have one bull and 40 cows. I mean, monogamy is not common in nature. It's not. And the same with murder. You think murder's not common in nature? You got to see what a skunk does when it gets into a hen house. It doesn't go in there to eat meat. It goes in there to slaughter and to kill. And the same thing with incest. See, incest is so common in nature that a cowboy won't ride a Mustang because Mustangs have been inbred for so long, they're absolutely worthless. They bred within the herds. Well, if you're saying the laws of nature, then how do you explain things like theft and adultery and murder and incest? Well, I can't. And that's where God helped us out by giving us not only the laws of nature. He gave us the laws of nature's God. And the laws of nature's God, things like the Ten Commandments. He says, no, adultery's out. By the way, murder's out. Here's the laws of consanguinity. You can't marry close relatives. See, that's where you have the laws of nature and the laws of nature's God. Between those two things right there, it gives you everything you need to know on what's right and what's wrong. And that's the moral law. And that's what we recognize in the Declaration. That's the Scriptures. And by the way, that is what formed the common law in the Seventh Amendment, was the biblical definitions of what's right and wrong. That does not change across time. Even today, Christians say, well, you know, I live under the New Testament, not the Old Testament. I always ask them, I say, do you think arson's wrong? Of course I do. Do you think kidnapping's wrong? Absolutely. Do you think infanticide's wrong? Yes, I do. Do you think bestiality, sex with animals, is wrong? Yes. I said, show me any New Testament verse that deals with that, because none of them do. That's all Old Testament stuff. You see, once God tells us something is wrong, it stays wrong until He gives us notice that it's changed. So what He said is wrong in the Old Testament, that's not how we become righteous, is what happened in the Old Testament, but He gives us the rights and wrongs, and we still hold that. That's the common law. That's what we have in the Constitution. So that's the fourth. The fifth thing that I'll quickly point to here is governments instituted among men deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed. Now, the consent of the governed, this is where we get the idea of majority rules. George Washington defined it this way. He was from the Federalist Party, the political party known as Federalist. He said, the fundamental principle of our Constitution requires that the will of the majority shall prevail. Thomas Jefferson was the head of the Anti-Federalist Party. This is one time when both parties absolutely agreed. Thomas Jefferson said, the will of the majority is the natural law of every society and the only sure guardian of the rights of man. They're big time into majority wins, except in two areas. See, that's why this came next. You've already established inalienable rights. You've already established moral law. You don't get to vote on the moral law, and you don't get to vote on inalienable rights. Now, we can vote on whether the sidewalk should be 4 feet wide, 5 feet wide, or 6 feet wide. We can vote on whether the speed limit should be 45, 55, 60, or if you're in Texas, 85 is our speed limit in Texas. We can vote on all those kind of things, but we can't vote on whether, you know, we had a referendum, and 97.3% of the people said that rape is no longer a crime. I'm sorry, it's going to be a crime because it violates the laws of nature and nature's God. We have a moral standard that we cannot violate. You know, we decided, and we've done all the polling, and we decided there's not going to be a right to life anymore. Sorry, that's an inalienable right. You don't get a vote on that. So the consent of the government only works below inalienable rights and below the moral law. You don't get a vote on that. See, that's... And that's what we understood for so long. So that's the fifth thing, is the consent of the governed. Now notice what we have here. The five things to review quickly. There's a divine creator. The creator gives certain guaranteed rights. The government exists to protect those rights. There is a fixed moral law, and there's a consent of the governed. Notice the first four things are absolutely God-centered, which is why a secular government will never be a limited government. You see, a secular government thinks that everything originates from itself. So everything it gives, government gave us the right to conscience. That's why I can regulate the right to conscience. Parents give us the right to life. That's why government can regulate the right to life. It doesn't come from God. See, all these inalienable rights that are going out the door is because we don't recognize the Creator anymore. We don't recognize fixed moral laws that He has given to mankind. And you think of any secular government in the world, and try to find if it's a limited government. Does France qualify? No. How about Greece? Maybe Cuba? How about Venezuela? Maybe Chile? Maybe Sweden? You can't think of a secular government in the world that is a limited government. They get into every aspect of life because they think everything comes from them. It's only when you have that limitations, and that is what is key. You see, the key to limited government is for it to recognize jurisdictional lines or to recognize what belongs to it and what doesn't. That's that thing of the white pickup versus the red pickup. I can't paint somebody else's pickup. Jesus told us this in Matthew 22:21, where he says, you render to Caesar what's Caesar's, to God what's God's. There are clear jurisdictional lines. Some things belong to God. They are not to be touched by Caesar. Now, we used to understand this. I want to show you a court decision that happened with marriage, regard to marriage. And by the way, you remember marriage? You have God creating everything in Genesis 1-3. He said, it's good, it's good, it's good. And then you get to Adam and Eve and the family. He said, that's very good. It's not just good, it's very good. So the family comes in before there's ever civil government. That is an inalienable right, right to family, right to marriage, right to have a male and female. So that's an inalienable right. And then over Jesus, Matthew 19, they said, how about the thing on divorce? And Jesus said, don't you remember? From the beginning, God had one man, one woman, put them together. He said, what God's joined together, let not man put asunder. It's a lifetime union. Jesus defined marriage as a lifetime union of a man and a woman. That's the definition of marriage from God. Okay? So since that's God's definition, government's not allowed to touch it. I'm going to show you a court case from 1913 that dealt with the issue of civil unions. Way back in 1913, civil jurisdictions of marriage. Can you have a secular equivalent of what the church, you know, church has got marriage. Let's have government have marriage, too. No, here's what the court said. 1913, Grigsby versus Reed. The court said marriage was not originated by human law. When God created Eve, she was a wife to Adam. They then and there occupied the status of husband to wife and wife to husband. The truth is a civil government has grown out of marriage, which created homes and population society from which government became necessary. Marriage will produce a home and a family, and that contribute to a good society, to free and just government, to the support of Christianity. It would be sacrilegious to apply the designation a civil contract to such a marriage. It's that and more. It's a status ordained by God. Hey, I can't go over and paint my neighbor's pickup. Because that's God's pickup. I got to stay here in my yard. See, we recognize jurisdictional lines. If it belonged to God, we didn't mess with it. We didn't redefine marriage. We didn't try to make a secular equivalent of it because that was God's property and we could not deal with it. Now that we have become secular in so many areas, look how that we're having infringements on things like the right to life, on things like traditional marriage, on things like the rights of conscience, on religious expressions, on the right of self-defense. All these inalienable rights no longer are the further we move away from God as a people and as a nation. So I'll close with this statement by Thomas Jefferson. Jefferson, this is a statement came from the first book he wrote, 1781, is engraved in stone inside the Jefferson Memorial. It says this, can the liberties of a nation be thought secure when we have removed their only firm basis? Now grab this. Jefferson, our least religious founding father, least is a comparative term. Our least religious founding father says, what's the only firm basis of national liberties? He said, it is a conviction. Notice the word conviction. He said, it is a conviction in the minds of the people that these liberties are the gift of God and they're not to be violated but with His wrath. He said, indeed, I tremble for my country when I reflect that God is just and His justice won't sleep forever. According to Thomas Jefferson, what's the only firm basis of national liberties? It is a conviction that those liberties are the gift of God and that if we start screwing around with them, we're going to tick Him off and then we're all going to be in trouble. That's Jefferson telling us this. The only firm basis of our liberties is the conviction of God. And as education becomes more secular, as the nations become more secular, we don't recognize inalienable rights anymore. So the right to life, I mean, we go back to the philosophy that made us who we were. It was the right to life. On all these issues, the philosophy that produced us was first a right to life. We have to go back to that as the first guiding fundamental principle. If we don't get that right, we won't get the economics right. We won't get the jobs right. We won't get anything right if we don't get the first of those inalienable rights right. If you're interested in this kind of stuff, out back we have what's called the Founders Bible, which is the founders themselves talking about the biblical principles they used to craft things like the abortion issue and so many others as well. So thank you guys for letting me share with you. God bless you.
You have been listening to David Barton, president and founder of Wall Builders and keynote speaker for the 2014 Bringing America Back to Life Symposium. This presentation was brought to you by Cleveland Right to Life, where through prayer, action, voting, and education, we are bringing America back to life.